Go ahead.
Apologies.
No, no problem. We take a few minutes to get our recording set up between arguments anyway. Our clerk will call the next case.
The court will now call Michael Henderson from the state of Texas, the man from the court, Ms. Lisa Mullins, the woman from the appellate, Mr. Edward Wilkinson, the woman from the state.
Mullen, I'm sorry, were you ready to proceed? I saw you.
Yes, I just saw, I think one of the litigants left their backpack.
Oh, okay.
So I was just wondering if anybody wanted to get it.
Ron, do you want to get that? Thank you.
All right, very good. May it please the court, good morning. And happy Valentine's Day. I first wanted to thank the court for the opportunity to present argument in this case. Obviously, the brief is exceedingly long and 10 points of error, a lot of issues argued. So I tried to hone it down to the specific issues, really of more concern or interest on my part, but not to waive any of the other ones, obviously. But I do appreciate the court's time. I always enjoy the opportunity to argue to you all. The first issue I want to talk about is the extraneous offense issue, which obviously permeates the viability of the entirety of the procedures from my perspective, as far as justice goes, as far as what should have been allowed, and as far as what requires reversal from this court. This is a case of capital murder where Mr. Henderson was charged with killing an individual in the course of a robbery. The death penalty was waived, so when the jury came back with a guilty verdict, it was an automatic life sentence. The general facts of the case are that Mr. Henderson, as the evidence reflected, killed a homeless man in an effort to obtain his identity. That was the robbery, is the robbery of his identity and his items of property that would reflect an identity. The evidence showed that after he had killed the individual, he put him in the trunk of appellant's own vehicle in furtherance of trying to show that it was actually him that was dead in the vehicle, set the car on fire with the girlfriend, and left his own identification there so that when the police arrived, they would think it was him who was deceased and burnt in the vehicle. Obviously, that was found not to be true relatively quickly as law enforcement arrived at the car that was still on fire. The issue as to the extraneous offense in the case was that the state was offering an extraneous offense concerning continuous sexual abuse of a relative, and I speak in generalities. My brief says more, but because of the fact that it's recorded to protect identity, I will speak in that generality, but I'm sure the court's aware of whom I'm speaking of. Continuous sexual abuse of a child who was related was offered as evidence to prove motive in this case. Just speaking those words, continuous sexual abuse of a child, obviously has inherent prejudice that permeated this entire trial, which was supposed to be a capital murder trial. The state offered that as evidence of motive. Under 404, I made arguments under Chapter 4, obviously, of the rules of evidence. Under 401, though, we'll start with that discussion because the relevance of that to prove anything as far as motive to kill is absolutely, in my opinion, non-existent. I understand the state can make an argument that it's minimally relevant, but in reality, if you think about it, the motive to kill is inherent in the factual scenario that I just described to you. It was clear from the facts of the case that the motive to kill the victim in this incident was in order to obtain his identity, ergo the robbery. So that it's factually dependent. So the fact that there's a sexual assault that he perhaps is running from the law is a secondary motive relevance factor, if you understand what I'm saying. Motive is not necessarily needed to be proven anyway. We all know that. But even if the state wants to argue that they needed to prove a motive to kill, they had it from the facts of the case. It was clear from the witnesses and the facts that his motive to kill the poor gentleman was to obtain his identity, as the facts laid out. So the lack of a need for a motive at all shows that this is not relevant, this aggravated sexual continuous abuse evidence in this case.
Ms. Mullen.
Yes, Your Honor.
What did the evidence
show about the interrelationship among, between the appellant and the victim of the murder?
Total strangers. He was, the victim was a homeless gentleman, and from my understanding, they didn't know each other at all.
And you don't view that as a factor that is significant in explaining to a jury the motivation for a killing?
No, Your Honor, not when, in this particular case, the motivation for the killing was absolutely explained by the facts of the case itself. Without any other evidence that he was in wanting to get away from the police, or there's a myriad of other areas, and I'll get to that in a minute, but just the fact that he killed him, that he put his body in his own vehicle, took it out to a park, set it on fire, strewn his own identity out on the ground, made statements that he needed a new identity, things of that nature, in and of itself proves the motive for why he intended to kill the victim in this case.
So you think that why he wanted a new identity is not relevant?
I would say that's a secondary motive issue, which strains relevance in this particular case. That's my argument as far as relevance goes. Also, he was found with the documents. The evidence reflected. He was actually had the documents, the birth certificate of the victim, other items of evidence that I'm not recalling right this moment that belonged to him that would prove identity. He'd also signed documents he'd actually taken on the name of the victim. So not only does that show an intent to do it, it shows just by the facts of the case that motive is proven and that he's already taken on the identity of the victim in this case. So he's doing exactly what he set out to do in the motive for the actual killing. That's on the relevance standard. But when we get, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 situation that the appellant here had to have in his mind something to do by way of escape from the arrest warrants that were out for him because of the earlier crime? That's his whole situation. I'm where I am, and I know what's going to happen. I know there's arrest warrants out for me. I know there's going to be testimony. I don't know that he believed he was going to be found guilty, but he didn't deny that the facts of what occurred put him in position where he had to be the subject of that kind of criminal activity. There wasn't much of an investigation to determine the facts of the earlier incident. Do you agree with me there?
I agree with you to some regard, yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, how can it be anything but a continuous picture of what occurred in this transaction down to the time that the appellant made the determination and then acted on it to kill and obtain a person he might substitute in a way that looked like he was dead? I mean, it looks to me like the flow of what occurred here is the overwhelming reason why the prosecutors felt they needed to show what happened earlier, because of the bizarre conduct of finding a person that you don't know at all, perfect stranger, total stranger, and deciding and killing him to be used in this plan.
Right. So you're going under the theory of a continuing course of conduct, basically, is what I'm hearing, and I do understand that. With all respect to the court, what I think changes that factor or makes the extraneous offense of the continuous sexual abuse of the child inadmissible in that chain of events is Rule 403. Prejudicial versus probative. And what I'm trying to start out with, it's minimally probative or needed from the evidence in this case because motive is clear,
and
the direct
motive.
The
decision as to whether this is applicable, 403 is violated, is a discretionary decision made by the trial judge.
That's correct, unless the record shows that it is an abuse of discretion in that balancing. And I will point out to the court that the balancing was one sentence in this particular case.
Well, the announcement of the effect of the balancing was one sentence, but you actually had a pretrial hearing.
That's correct, wherein nobody discussed other methodologies of proof of motive other than there was absolutely no questions made. Is there other ways to prove this? It's not so astronomically prejudicial. There was not a discussion had. The judge didn't inquire as such. There was general arguments about other.
I think the astronomical reference might be a little bit stronger than what the judge was required to find here in order to determine that there wasn't a violation of 403.
Right. The question relies on whether its probative value might have been outweighed by substantial prejudice. And I'll go ahead and jump to the first factor, and that is the prejudice. That's the first thing you look at. Basically, in the inquiry, there should be three questions the judge is supposed to look at, and this court now can look at, and that is the inherent prejudicial value of the extraneous offense being offered. The second is other means of proof. Is there other means of proof that are not that highly prejudicial that can be proffered? And the third is, does it divert the juror's attention away from the actual elements of the offense that we're talking about? So if we take those in turn and just look at the first, yes, Judge?
I'm having trouble figuring out the difference in the elements.
Okay. The difference in the elements of?
Of a capital murder and of the man and taking his possessions.
Okay.
Maybe I'm having trouble seeing what harm it would be to him. The punishment for a conviction of capital murder.
Yes.
Is that life or death?
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm sorry, I probably didn't make myself clear. I kind of skimmed over that a little bit. The charge was
wondering.
Murder in the course of robbery is what made it a capital murder. So it's murder intentionally, knowingly causing the death of the victim in this case with the intent to commit robbery, i.e. steal his property, was the allegation. Okay. And that is a capital murder case, but the state waived the death penalty. And so when the jury said guilty on that charge, finding robbery and murder, it was an automatic life sentence. So how am I confusing the court? I'm sorry.
No. I'm just wondering what difference it makes about how harmful the other evidence would be.
Well,
it paints a picture, and yes, it might be harmful if you were thinking of giving 5 to 50 years in prison.
Okay.
I don't see how the.
I see what you're saying.
Would be effective.
Right, not necessarily the punishment, but finding somebody guilty under the prism of, in the beginning of the trial of, an entire continuous sexual abuse trial before we ever get to elements of murder and robbery might taint a jury's perspective or introspection of the evidence in the case. That's where the harm is. Yes, because it's automatic life. Once they say guilty, we can't show harm at punishment. We discuss it as far as when they're discerning the evidence on guilt innocence, the identity issue, the elements of the offense itself.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen.
Yes, Judge.
And Ms. Mullen, but doesn't the extraneous offense evidence require a harm analysis as well? Doesn't it require us to look at if it was emphasized by the state and the degree of how heinous it is compared to the charged offense and the totality of the evidence of guilt, and don't we have to look at all that too?
Yes, I do. I think you do have to do that, and I think that goes into the prejudicial argument that I can make it just under the 403, 404, 401 arguments, how prejudicial it was just from the outset, and the fact that the state tried an entire sexual assault of a child case before they even brought in evidence of a murder. Which adds to the harm and the prejudice involved there. Something else that, since I'm running out of time, I've only gotten one of 10 talked about, but of utmost importance in this particular situation was the myriad of other evidence that was sufficient to show motive that was not prejudicial, that would not have denied this man a fair trial, and a jury looking at the evidence without the taint of the highly prejudicial information of the sexual assault of the child case. The other thing that I think is immensely important is courts are very careful and very mindful to introduce or allow introduction of this type of evidence because it is so inflammatory. And in the history of the courts, the Court of Criminal Appeals, this court allowing this type of extraneous evidence has always been very carefully limiting it, i.e., Why couldn't they have just said he was wanted for sexual assault of a child? Wouldn't that be enough of a motive? But instead, what we had in this particular case was the state was allowed to introduce the entire trial, the victim's testimony, the outcry testimony, the rape exam testimony, and how that is relevant to a motive in this particular case, honestly, misses me. The DNA afterwards was all, it was like he was on trial for continuous sexual abuse of a child, and the fact that it was continuing was also carefully laid out by the state in the record as well, and talked about in closing argument about the act being so heinous, when it's supposed to be relevant to proving motive, which could have been proven a million other ways, which was proven a million other ways by the state. His wife testified he was desperate to get a new identity. His girlfriend, eyewitness, oh, my time's up. Could I have just a minute?
You can finish.
His girlfriend testified as to the Mexican mafia were looking for him, as to that he wanted a new identity, as to exactly she saw. He said to her, I need a new identity. I'm desperate to get out of town. I'm going to Canada. All of that could have proven up the motive in this case without introducing an entire continuing sexual abuse, incestuous relationship, which only sought to destroy any kind of fairness in a jury's assessment of the evidence when determining whether or not he was guilty of the capital murder. Thank you.
Wilkinson?
May it please the court. Stripped of its essence, appellant's argument is essentially, stripped to its essence, appellant's argument is essentially that his motive for killing a homeless stranger was so horrific that the jury should have been barred from hearing it. To a certain degree, the argument answers itself. Motive is always relevant. The Court of Criminal Appeals has consistently held, and other courts, intermediate courts have consistently held, that motive is always relevant, so long as proof fairly tends to raise an inference in favor of the existence of a motive on the part of the accused to commit the alleged offense. The state maintains that the evidence in this case fits that definition squarely. It falls under, it is not inadmissible under Rule 402. As to this motive once removed argument, just to say that he killed the victim to obtain his documents, or even to say he obtained his evidence, goes to show motive for fleeing, perhaps, but it doesn't go to show motive for murdering him and then putting his body into the trunk and burning his own car. It's well known now, there are many ways to steal someone's identity without murdering them. You can do it over the internet, you can either get the documents in all sorts of other ways. He could have simply stolen them. It doesn't explain the murder. What explains the murder is the fact that he had sexually assaulted his daughter, she had complained to the police, she had made went to the nurse and was examined immediately after the assault. The police were called in, the DNA tests were done, and proved that he did it. So that he knows that, and he knows, so this is probably what's most important, he knows that she's gone to the police and that the police are investigating it. So he knows if he's caught, he's going to be tried for it, he's going to be convicted for it, and he's going, in all probability, to have a very long sentence. That radically increases the need to not only switch identities, but to have someone take his place, basically to take the heat off of him. And he can do that by killing the victim, putting his body where the police can find it, and trying to convince the police that that's him, that they no longer need to search for him.
If evidence of motive is always relevant, is there no line as to how much of the extraneous offense can be proved up to establish motive? Can you do a trial within a trial, essentially?
Typical lawyer's answer, it depends. That's where 403 comes in. And very often, if you have minor offenses and you're trying to get in extreme extraneous offenses, the balance under 403 would tend to say, no, we need to keep that out, or we need to limit it to some degree. In this case, however, the accused, the offense for which he's accused of is so extreme in and of itself, that balance has suddenly changed. It's not a minor offense, and the state's trying to prove up an extraneous offense that is horrific. It's a horrific offense, and the state is establishing the motive for the horrific offense is that he committed another horrific offense, and he's trying to get away with it. So, to go back to appellant's position, 402 doesn't apply. 404B doesn't apply because 404B is a rule of inclusion, not exclusion. That is, it only excludes evidence in which evidence is put on to prove character and further to prove conduct in accordance with that character. If you put it on for any other reason, it's admissible under 404B. And in this case, the state proffered the evidence for the purpose of motive and flight. So the first two are down, 402, 404B. We get to 403. We'll go back to the balancing. Under the test for 404, the actual 404, sorry, it's been a while since I've done this. The test under 403 is, as this court well knows, is whether the probative value of the evidence is significantly outweighed by its prejudicial effect, not by its substantial prejudicial effect, as I think counsel misspoke, but I want to make sure it gets that straight, whether substantially outweighed by the danger of the danger of the prejudicial effect. The court of criminal appeals has come up with a four-prong test to determine whether evidence is admissible under 403. Sorry. The state has gone to great lengths in its brief, but I'll touch on it very briefly here. First, the probative value of the evidence. Here, the probative value of the evidence of motive is great. And as I say, it goes not only to show why he's fleeing from the police and why he's stealing this guy's identity, but why he murders them and then stages this elaborate crime scene. So the first prong goes in favor of the state. The second prong is probably the most problematic, to be honest. That is whether the potential to impress the jury is in some irrational way. Here it does have that. The state will concede that. But that must be weighed against, again, the possibility of impressing the jury with the very facts of the offense itself. And as this court has said in Estes, where they're similar or one may outweigh the other, we're going to weigh on whether, we're going to go with the trial court and whatever the trial court's call on that was. And in this case, the trial court, in its discretion, deemed to admit the evidence before the jury. So that prong goes to the state as well. The third prong is the time to develop the evidence. The time to develop the evidence in this case was very short. The entire testimony that we're talking about, the testimony of the child victim, the testimony of the nurse, and the testimony of the DNA expert, is less than 80 pages in, a 10-volume, 1,000-page record. So the state, and the hearing, the pretrial hearing on this really only takes about 3 pages. And in that hearing, by the way, and this sort of goes back to your question, Justice Walker, in that hearing, it's very broad. It's very, we're going to put on the victim. They don't get into the details of what each witness is going to testify to. We're going to bring, and in fact, the state even says it's going to put on four witnesses, I think, that they never actually introduce. The entire record of that pretrial hearing only takes 3.5 pages of the record. Very little time on it. Very broad strokes, too. So that in a brief, appellant complains about specific instances of evidence that they maintain now shouldn't have come in. They never objected to it at trial, and it was never raised in pretrial. The trial court never had an opportunity to rule on those specifics. Only rule broadly on whether, in general, this sort of evidence could come in. The state maintains it was incumbent upon the defendant, appellant, to object to that, either in pretrial, specifically saying, how broad is this going to be, what sort of details are you getting into, or should have objected when the witnesses began testifying. A running objection, we maintain, is not going to cover that. Otherwise, all defendants will simply say, we object to all extraneous evidence and let it go with that. And the trial courts never will have an opportunity to rule on specific until it's too late, basically. Or the state is required then to self-police themselves, which would be difficult, to say the least. Finally, the fourth prong of the test is the need for the evidence. And the state again maintains the need for the evidence is high. Justice Myers, as you suggested, the murder is senseless without knowing what the underlying motive is. To simply say he wanted to steal his identity isn't sufficient. Identity theft, as everyone knows, is sadly fairly common in today's society. Murders for the purpose of identity theft aren't. For the jury to understand why the murder was committed has to understand the underlying motive for everything. And the state, by the way, would rely on the cases of Gosh and Moore. Gosh is particularly. In Gosh, the Court of Criminal Appeals allowed the state to put on evidence that the defendant kidnapped the wife of a bank president, held her for a while, tried to get the ransom, and then in the kidnapping, the botched kidnapping, ended up murdering the wife. In that case, the state was allowed to put on evidence that the motive for the kidnapping was so that the defendant could get the money from the bank president, then use that money to get false documents to flee to Belize to escape federal warrants on a weapons charge. The state would draw the parallel between Gosh and this case. There's a direct line between the defendant, appellant here, trying to escape a certain conviction in a long, long prison sentence and the ultimate murder of the victim. I think that takes care of the first point of error, but if the court has any questions, or you can either refer to the state's brief, which both briefs are extremely detailed in this case, or I can answer them now. If the court has any other questions about any of the points of the error, I'm happy to try. All right. The state prays for an affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. Have rebuttal, Ms. Mullen?
I guess just to take up my last few minutes. I probably wouldn't have time to delve into another issue, so I'll leave that to my brief. But I don't think on the first issue I wanted to point out a little bit of rebuttal. The first is that I think the state was trying to make an argument that there was not an appropriate objection to the exact evidence that was introduced. And as an appellate attorney, I can honestly say the objections in this particular case were thankfully over and over and over again. I hardly find a record where I'm happy with the objections that trial counsel made, honestly. But in this particular instance, there was pretrial, and I would disagree with the state. I do think it's incumbent upon the court, as the Montgomery case talks about, to inquire as far as other types of evidence that is less prejudicial that can prove the same motive. So that hearing was, they acted as the state also, I think, has to make an honest effort to apprise the judge of what evidence they're intending to offer. And if they're offering it generally and with the intent of offering it specifically later, that lies on the state. That does not lie on the defense. The defense objected to this line of questioning throughout the trial, constant running objections to every specificity. And in fact, I think it was Bill Ray, Mr. Ray made a statement at one point, are we trying a murder case? I mean, you know, I had no idea, indicating I didn't have any idea we were trying a complete continuous sexual abuse case before we even talked about what I'm here to defend this man on. To your issue, Justice Meyer, on the continuous course of conduct sort of avenue or appreciation, and I appreciate that argument when you look at these circumstances. Obviously, nobody's saying appellant is a saint. I'm sure none of us would want to have dinner with him. So the fact that he's committed some heinous offenses is conceded on this record. However, the real issue here is a fair trial, regardless of how heinous these acts are that he's accused of. And that is my concern, and that's why we have Rule 403. because 403 is the big equalizer under the law. And the state can throw in all kinds of evidence to show that somebody is just a horrible person. And in this case, they did, because they also threw in a bunch of evidence of other motives that were a lot less benign and a lot less prejudicial, inherently prejudicial, to this man getting a fair trial on the capital murder charge, i.e. that he was running from the Mexican mafia. That's extraneous. That's bad. But somebody might be desperate enough to obtain a new identity for that. That's sufficient. The girlfriend, who was an eyewitness, and he told her exactly why he wanted to kill a complete stranger. So they had proof of all of this without the highly prejudicial and impactful testimony concerning this extraneous aggravated sexual assault, and proven like it was in a complete trial. And that's what I was trying to get at earlier that I don't think I said very artfully. When you look at the extraneous offense admissibility dicta or history of admission by all of our courts in Texas, if you really look at that, especially the case the state was talking about, this kind of wholesale trial within a trial evidence has never been admitted before and allowed in a court of appeals. And you can look at those cases. I point that out in my brief, but there's an example of this golf case that he's talking about. It was a kidnapping, killing of a bank president's relative or wife, and they were allowed to introduce the fact of some sort of fraud that went on as a motive to do that. I can get with that. I can understand that. That's because 403 and the balancing of the prejudicial versus the probative doesn't weigh very high. If you're going to say he did a fraudulent activity and that's why he wanted to kill her, is very different than saying that this man is an incestuous pedophile on a continuous basis and having that prejudicial impact permeate the entire trial from the very beginning that would affect the way that jury would look at any other evidence. He was convicted before it began based on the highly prejudicial nature of this evidence. So if you have any other questions. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Ms. Mullen. Thank you, Mr. Wilkinson. We appreciate your arguments. Your case is submitted, and our clerk will adjourn court.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals of the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.